Thanks. Tim, alcoholic.
All right, guys, we're going to rock and roll tonight. We're in Bill's story. We're on page one. Chapter one, Bill's story. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us into their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. So let's just stop there for a second. Let's get ourselves oriented to what the heck we're talking about. Let's get a timeline here. So let's deal with the first line. War fever ran high. What war? World War One. So basically, World War One is 1914 to 1918, but the U.S. does not get in until 1917. We get in late in the game. So Bill's voice in writing in this is 1917. So the New England town, sticking with that first line, the New England town he's referring to is New Bedford, Mass. It's a port town. And his army regiment is waiting there to ship out to end up over in England. So we're in New Bedford, Mass, and they've just gone to line two and three. They've just come from Plattsburgh, New York. Plattsburgh is sometimes spelt with an E at the end. It's the same place, but Plattsburgh, New York. And he just trained as an army officer. He's a second lieutenant artillery. And he's at Fort Rodman. So they're waiting to ship out. And what he's alluding to here is that the society families have invited the officers over for cocktails. And we're going to see what happens when that transpires. I was part of life at last. And in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. So what we're talking about here is Bill's first drink. First drink ever, 1917. I have a little photo here. You can come later on and see it. But it is Norwich Academy. This is where he trained as a military college. Also in Vermont, Norwich Academy. It's the oldest private military academy still in existence. And Bill, while he's there, he's actually in the Vermont National Guard. And as soon as war is declared in 1917 by the U.S., he becomes a U.S. Army officer, second lieutenant artillery. That's him in his duds. So he's discovered liquor. How does he discover liquor? He's been invited to one of these cocktail parties. What's his first drink? A Bronx cocktail, it's called. And I know you're dying to know what's in it. So it's gin, sweet vermouth, dry vermouth, and OJ. In the 1930s, it becomes the number three most popular worldwide cocktail, probably due to Bill's partaking. Right? In the 30s, he's drinking it in 1917, but in the 30s, it's voted the number three most popular cocktail internationally. So where does he have the drink? Obviously, New Bedford, Mass., but this is the mansion he drinks it in. The Grinnells have invited him over, and he has his first drink, and as you can see, this truly is a mansion, the Grinnell Mansion. And what happens in his first time drinking? Throws up. First time out of the gate. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink, meaning his family. In time, we sailed for over there, meaning Europe, meaning England specifically. They go from New Bedford, Mass., they go down to New York, pick up some more troops or supplies or whatever the heck, and they ship out over to England to prepare to go into France where the battle is. This is the ship he goes out on. This is an English transport ship, the HMT Lancashire. HMT, Her Majesty's Transport. You can come up and see that later on. I know it's not a clear picture. But he's nervous when he's on the ship. He's afraid he's not going to be a good leader. Right? He's got relatives that were in the Civil War that really showed their grit. And he's concerned he's not going to be able to live up to it. There's a background story on what happens on the ship, but we won't do it tonight. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Actually, the tombstone was a replacement, but it was originally written in 1764. And he says, it says, "Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot." And for those interested, this is a replacement tombstone. This is the replacement done. It was replaced a couple of times, but this is from 1966. It was replaced again, that same soldier. And you can see that although he only read it a couple times, he got the gist of it. I'm actually impressed. Years later, he remembered what it said. "Ominous warning, which I fail to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation." Do we know what this token of appreciation was? He got a watch, a ring, and a chain. I'm working on a couple of them, but here's the ring, and you can see the inscription if you want to come up later on. But the men gave him some nice tokens for their appreciation of him being a good officer to them. They also gave it to his captain. Both of them received something. "My talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with utmost assurance. I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company." So he took a night law course. We're now talking 1921 to 24. He took this course at Brooklyn Law School, and he ends up with a job with the U.S. Fidelity and Guarantee Company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife." So here's the first reference to Lois. Here's sort of the classic picture of Lois later on in life. This is not in 1921-24. "We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me." Did he actually graduate?
No.
He did not, and here's the gig behind that. They had a weird rule that you had to pick up the diploma in person, but the true alcoholic finished the course, right? He was drunk at that exam he told you about. He went back and he finished it. But they had a rule that said you had to pick it up in person. He said, "I'm not picking it up." Never got it. And that was their rule for graduation. I don't know if I read this. "By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on." One of the reasons Lois was sort of into going on this trip was because she had learned over a period of time that every time she got Bill out of the city and camping or on a road trip, drinking dramatically reduced. She thought that was going to fix him. Help fix him. We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of Financial Reference Service. So here's a picture of Bill and Lois with their Harley with the sidecar. And you'll also see some pictures when we do the history presentation. You'll see some pictures of her actually driving the motorcycle too. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. This references to a farm they worked on in Schenectady, New York. They were doing the whole East Coast. He's going to look at all the major factories and businesses and make reports back to Wall Street and hopefully make something for himself. And they're up in the Schenectady area, and Ella Goldfoot's farm took them in. Lois did a lot of housekeeping stuff. Bill worked out in the fields and did a bunch of farm-type manual labor. But the beauty of this and why he stayed so long was the wife, the wife and husband, had two sons that worked for GE. And he convinced them in the bar at night to let him on the property, and he got a look into the factories to see how far ahead of the game General Electric was. They were 10 years ahead of everybody else. He knew a little bit about radio stuff, and if you go up to his house in Vermont, in East Dorset, Vermont, you can see a little radio he built himself as a kid. So he had some radio knowledge. So he gave the thumbs up to GE. Probably a good call, right? So that's why they worked there for a month. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. Now we're talking 1926 to 29. That sentence is referencing that. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Jazz places uptown. He lives in Brooklyn. Why is he up there? Prohibition. 18th Amendment. 18th Amendment goes from 1919 to 1933. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but if his first drink is in 1917 and his last drink is in 34, he only drank legally for about 2 years. Right? 2.5 years. You think about that one, right? Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weather friends. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. So I used our little trusty dictionary for remonstrances, and that's the protests of my friends. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. Why does it say apartment? It should really say apartments, right? Because he rents one and he's making so much money, he rents the one next door and blows out the wall to make it one. This is the kind of money the man's making at that time. At that time, he's living about 2 or 3 blocks away from 182 Clinton Street. He and Lois have their own apartment, but it's not sumptuous enough. He makes two into one. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. In 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country, meaning Manchester, Vermont, My wife to applaud while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Sounds like progression. Golf permitted drinking every day and now every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. So remember, he lives in East Dorset, Vermont. He's basically a townie. It's 6 miles away from Manchester, Vermont. Everybody in Manchester, Vermont were summer people, right? They lived in Albany or New York or Boston or Providence, and they came up just to get out of the city for the summer. Bill lived there all the time, right? But he rubbed elbows with them, but he was really of different stock, right? So this exclusive course that all those summer people had dinners at and played at and the parents were members of, he was never on. And in fact, this is the course, and this is the Native American way. We'd normally say equinox, you know, equinox. But this is the Native American way of saying that word. Right? And that's the sign out. That's the current sign. That's the sign outside the country club. I acquired the impeccable coat of a tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ 32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. I was finished. It was 52 and it's down to 32. Why is he finished? I know it's down $20 a share, but why is he finished? He bought it on margin, right? So once it goes below a certain level, it's a margin call. They sell you out. They want to get their money back. They lent you the money to buy the number of shares you got. So not only do you have zero, you owe whatever the difference is that you borrowed. The papers reported men jumping to debt. Oh, I'm sorry. And what was the stock? It says XYZ. That's phony. What was it? Pennock and Ford. Who said it? Pennock and Ford. Corn syrup products, maple syrup, stuff that Bill was familiar with. Growing up in Vermont, he actually even made maple syrup. He harvested it from trees. So he knew a little bit about the gig. Pennock and Ford. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. Notice he capitalized it, meaning it's a false god. They're worshiping at that altar. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million. I thought you'd like that. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left and thought I better go to Canada. So this is Dick Johnson. He's actually a partner. Him and another guy are partners of Green Shields and Company. It's a brokerage house up in Canada, a medium-sized brokerage house. And he offers Bill a job. So he's all hooked up again. United States, they're going into depression. He gets a nice job up in Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. Now, you know, Elba and St. Helena, whichever you prefer, were both places where Napoleon was put as a detainment, right? He escaped from Elba. I believe he died at St. Helena. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. Progression. We went to live with my wife's parents. So Bill's wife's parents are Dr. and Mrs. Burnham. and they go to Brooklyn Heights, and they go to 182 Clinton Street, and this is the brownstone, still there, and this is where also where Lois was born. I found a job, then lost it as the result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years, or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. So this is her Macy's department store days. This is from 31 to 34. She works in Macy's, 31 to 34. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Progression. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day and often 3, got to be routine. Why did we call it bathtub gin? Very close. Sam was real close on that one. So it was made in the traditional still sort of way, but it was pure alcohol at the end. It was pure alcohol at the end. They're not giving you a bottle of pure alcohol. They give you this much alcohol, but the bottle wouldn't fit in the sink. They wanted to add water to it. Where would it fit? Bathtub. Bathtub gin. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. Not his other debts, at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. Progression. A tumbler full of gin, followed by a half dozen bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety, which renewed my wife's hope. Working on self-will still, right? He's going to bull his way through this thing. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder, meaning the 182 Clinton. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1934, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. So we know this little backstory, right? This is the story where he gets this group together and they said, no, Jim, they go, Bill, I was talking to myself, did you see that? They said, Bill, you drink too much and you're going to screw this thing up. But I'm going to make a contract. If you drink one drink during this gig, you're out. You lose everything. You forfeit the whole gig. He says, no problem. Give me the paper. And he signs with full confidence. And he's sitting at night. They had done some sort of business shenanigans, or sitting around playing cards or something, and somebody passes around Jersey Lightning. Joe and Charlie do this little skit. They do it better than me. So they pass around this bottle of Jersey Lightning, and Bill says, nah, I'm not drinking tonight. Goes around again. Nope, I'm not drinking tonight. So using self-will, right? Goes around the third time or some number of times, and he says, you know what? I've never had Jersey Lightning before. Takes the drink and loses the whole gig on the spot. And Jersey Lightning is Applejack, for those who are interested. And you can ferment that all the way down and keep distilling it all the way down to like 30, 40 proof. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises. But my wife happily observed that this time I meant business. And so did I. And that was the first sheet that we're referring to tonight. And that's Bill's sweet promises. The ones that are dated, the four that are dated, are all written in the family Bible. Bill writes in the family Bible, this is to you, honey. I will not drink. I won't read them just to use time. You read them yourself. But these are the things he says in the Bible to say, I am not going to do this thing. And then the last one is a subsequent letter that he writes. And what did all of them end with? Failure. So, good intention doesn't get you anything. So, sweet promises, take a copy before you leave. Interesting. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. So he doesn't have the solution, which means he doesn't have a defense against the first drink. Mental obsession will always bring him back to the drink because he's still working on self-will. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. So again, we're still in 1932. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared to cross the street, lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. I read that mental fog as depression. That's how I read it. He was subject to depression. I'm reading between the lines there. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Those are geographics, right? Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow, I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leapt. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. Progression. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. And those of you who've seen pictures of Bill, he couldn't afford 40 pounds underweight, right? My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. So here we're talking about Bill's brother-in-law, married to his sister Dorothy. This is Dr. Leonard Strong, a physician. So Dr. Strong, and Bill's mother, this is a younger picture, Emily, Bill's mother, and Dr. Strong were instrumental in getting Bill into Towns Hospital. Towns Hospital, these two doors at the bottom, 292, 293 Central Park West. I did this picture the other day in another Big Book presentation. Somebody's in the room. She lived upstairs. This is an apartment, but this was her address. She goes, 292 Central Park, that's my address. You can't make stuff like that up. It's just... Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. And that's where I left you with the belladonna cure. This is merely from Wikipedia. I just copied and pasted and cleaned it up a little bit. You can Wikipedia it. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish, we're going to hear that word a lot, and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. And why is that cutting edge? Because up to that point, very, very few people thought it was a bodily problem. They thought it was only pull yourself up by the bootstraps and get a grip on this thing, buddy. They did not look at it as the phenomenon of craving, which was the Silkworth allergy theory, right? So you can also take that. And the doctor they're talking about there is Silkworth, obviously. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will, meaning self-will, is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. Isn't that the tricky thing? That we can really fight our way through so many different things, but when it gets to booze, we can't. That's the definition of a real alcoholic. Part of it, anyway. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. In other words, Bill's saying, I understand it now. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer. Self-knowledge. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank much once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. So our first reference under my brother-in-law, a physician, they place him in a nationally known hospital. That's the fall of 33. That's Bill's detox in Towns Hospital, first attempt. Fall of 33. He's now saying towards the end of the page, I returned to the hospital. This is July of 34. This is number two. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now, his number three time in two towns is not real clear. So what I do is I underline the word now here. These are only 5-day stints, right? So he does one and two, and he's out, right? He's out of the hospital as this next word comes. It's not clear in the text, but we know because we have the receipts from his coming out of the hospital. We know the dates, right? Now I was to plunge into the dark. He's out of the hospital, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Not clear. He goes back into the hospital for three. Stay with me here. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. This is September of 34. This is third visit. So between that word now, that I had you underline, and trembling, he went in and came out. Third visit. September of 34. It's not clear in the text. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. On Armistice Day, November 11th, 1934. I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. So I took my little trusty dictionary, which I think is a great little tool. Again, the reason why I'm hot on it, it's in the context of 1939 definition. Fourth dimension, something outside the range of ordinary experience, a dimension in addition to the three rectangular dimensions of length, breadth, and depth, which is often considered to be time, outside of time. Big spiritual phrase is usually, right? Okay, we're gonna go right here now. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. We're going to end there tonight, and that's where we're going to start with Ebby's visit the first thing next week. So you got to come back right there.